Well, we're well and truly into the second decade of the second millennium, and All in the Mind is turning 10. Natasha Mitchell with you, as I have been since 2002 when we kicked off the show, and on ABC Radio National Summer we've been digging into our rich archives for you. And look, the head is such an interesting play space for a science journalist. And over the last decade, we've tracked all sorts of technologies that look set to redefine the self and what we're capable of. Technologies like brain-machine interfaces, neural prosthetics for people who are paralysed, intelligent robots going to war, bionic eyes, and the prospects of stem cell therapy for diseases like Parkinson's, and so much more. And especially we've tracked the ethical dimensions of these endeavours. That's been a big focus of the show. So today's adventure into the archive, we're augmenting ourselves. It's the brave new brain.
Yes, it thinks. It knows we're here.
Back in 2003 on the show, the prospect of bionic brains and a silicon memory implant was on our minds, with philosopher of neuroscience Carl Craver.
They tried to reprogram his mind and something went wrong.
We're used to thinking of prosthetics as replacements for the tools with which we carry out our will. So we think of prosthetics as replacements for arms, or replacements for eyes, or replacements for ears. But we're not used to thinking of replacements for the very things that would have desires, the very things that would make decisions about our futures, the very things that shape our conception of who we are and so shape how we will act in the future.
Philosopher Carl Craver considering prosthetic replacements for when things go wrong inside your head. This month, researchers in the vanguard of neuroscience gathered for the first international conference on neural engineering in Italy. What caught the attention of the world's journalists was a presentation given by a leading biomedical engineer who hopes to wire up human brains with a silicon interface, even in the next decade or so. World's first brain prosthesis screamed the headlines. Theodore Berger and his team at the University of Southern California report that they've developed a prototype artificial hippocampus. That's the part of the brain involved in the storage of information as memories, and so crucial then to who we are. Conditions like Alzheimer's, epilepsy, or a stroke can damage the hippocampus, and more on that later. But the research team's ultimate goal is
to develop a neural prosthetic for the central nervous system to replace higher thought processes that have been lost due to damage. A neural prosthetic designed to replace damaged neurons in central regions of the brain with silicon neurons.
Memory is at the heart of our personality. And the prospect of replacing the hippocampus with an electrical implant moves from prosthesis as tool to prosthesis as decision maker. That raises a whole host of questions that I don't think that we have adequately grappled with yet.
Yeah, the bioethicist Arthur Kaplan, who's fairly optimistic about the brain revolution, he suggests that we're a little puritanical about the idea of mucking with our heads. And, I mean, this taps into this concern that you've expressed.
Right. One thing that I should do to temper my concern about this is to simply point out that we tend to think of cognition as something that happens inside our skulls, or at least inside our skins. But it's important to keep in mind that a lot of what we would call cognitive activity involves tools in our environment. We already count on our fingers and do math on paper. We remember things by writing them down in our day planners. We drive to a new city by following the road signs along the way. And all of those things are ways of using our environment as what Andy Clark called scaffolding for thinking. And so there's a real question about what difference there is between those kinds of environmental scaffolding and the kind of scaffolding that Berger's advance forces us to think about. What difference does it make whether the information that we're using in our environment is used by us through visual signals or auditory signals, or whether they're used through electrical signals running down wires?
So this is this notion of the extended mind that some philosophers are keen to propagate, that the mind is not encapsulated in our brain, not even within our body, but it is also so much integrated into our environment, our interactions.
That's exactly right. And that raises the question, what's the difference between these normal cases of extended cognition that we use unthinkingly on a daily basis and the kind of extended cognition that we're confronted with in the case of Berger's putative discovery?
I've never seen so many brains out of their heads before.
Carl Craver mentioned philosopher Andy Clark, and Clark would have to have been another one of my favourite interviews over the last decade on All in the Mind. In 2003, we were talking about his book Natural Born Cyborgs. You're one, by the way. So am I. Consider this. The human skin is an artificial boundary. The world wanders into it and the self wanders out of it. Traffic is two-way and constant. Those are the words from Bernard Woolf's classic 1952 book Limbo, one of the great dystopian novels of our time. In Woolf's story, set in 1990, neurosurgeon Dr. Martine lives in a world where, amongst other strange goings-on, men called queer limbs wander the landscape. Their arms and legs are amputated and replaced by atomic-powered plastic prostheses. Well, it's not as far-fetched a scenario as you might think.
You know, some of us find it kind of exciting, I think, and I'm probably kind of one of those who thinks, oh, that might be nice, you know, a bit of flesh-machine merging. But I know a lot of people have a sort of adverse reaction to it, and I think it must be this idea of sort of something unnatural about it. That's why I called the book Natural Born Cyborgs. The idea is really supposed to be that this kind of tendency is absolutely second nature, or maybe even first nature to us.
Well, let's look at that tantalising argument that you present, that in fact this post-human future that's suggested by the cyborg is in fact already here. We already are cyborgs. What are you getting at there?
There are some things that are distinctive of the human race here. We've got a lot of cortical plasticity, a lot more than any other animal on the planet. We have a long childhood, longer than any other animal on the planet. And in addition to that, we've got language. And somehow I think the combination of those three things has set us on a kind of track that no other animal has been able to go down. It's a track of building worlds to think in, building worlds to think with, and in the end, building worlds into ourselves and ourselves into our worlds.
So your suggestion is that we actually, our mind is a lot bigger than our body, that somehow we kind of incorporate the world around us into our mind.
Yeah, I guess the thought is that we're kind of set up to do that. So here's a kind of parallel. Some animals, but not all, have a sense of what's called haptic touch. Humans have it, chimpanzees have it. Haptic touch is a kind of sense whereby you can take a tool and you can very quickly come to treat it as if it was part of your body. For example, you can take a rake, and during a raking motion, if they record from cells in the monkey's brain, the cells that would normally represent the fingers of the hand can very quickly come to map the area of the tines of the rake. So in a way, immediately on the spot, the body image of the monkey has been adapted to encompass the tool. But I think that unlike the monkey, we do it for more cognitive things as well. Our brains are just set up to kind of loop out and exploit the environment around them for cognitive purposes.
Your own story starts with the loss of your laptop computer a few years ago, which you equate to the cyborg equivalent of having a stroke. I'm a bit worried about you, Andy.
It was not a happy day, let's put it that way. And I've had both kinds of stroke, actually. You know, I had the other kind about 7 years ago. I woke up one morning with a little bit of my visual field missing. And oddly enough, that morning I woke up and I thought, oh, a bit of the visual field gone, probably had a stroke. And I ignored it till later in the day, hoping it would just go away and repair itself. Eventually told my wife, she rushed me to hospital. It never came back. But the experience with the laptop, for me, was an awful lot worse at the time.
Really?
I had an awful lot more stuff in the laptop. I was really a very unbacked-up kind of person in those days. It was really rather awful. Now, you know, of course, there are many worse disasters that can befall a human being than losing their laptop. But I think that there is some sense in which we should begin to extend to some of our property just a little bit of the kind of concern that we normally have for ourselves, for our persons.
You use the example of the wristwatch and also the artist's palette. I think they're quite beautiful examples of describing this idea that you've offered to the world, which is that of the extended mind.
Somewhere close to a joke, isn't it? You say to someone, you know, do you know the time? And they say yes, and then they look at their watch. You can sort of challenge them, well, did you really know the time when you said yes? And they'll say, well, yeah, I knew how to get the time. And I think that's often what we do mean when we say, yes, we know things. We know how to get them from our long-term memory, from some reliable environmental resource, from wherever. The artist's sketch pad is kind of more interesting, I think, because for certain forms of abstract art, there's some actually some detailed psychological work out there show him how, if you like, looping your ideas out onto paper enables you to perform kinds of reorganization on the ideas that you can't perform in imagination. That's a good case because the abstract artist certainly thinks that that's their creation. They may be prone to commit what I call the naked brain fallacy, to create a nice piece of abstract art and then think, hey, my brain did all that.
Mm.
But no, those loops into the outside world play a crucial role in the genesis of these products that we take to be just our intellectual products, expressions of ourselves.
So in a sense, the naked brain as it sits in our body is only the incomplete mind. It's not all of our mind.
And I kind of think of the biological brain as something like the boot program of human intelligence. Kind of gets the thing going, but its job is to pull in all this other structure, to load up all this other stuff, and that's when we really become fully human.
Indeed. Philosopher of mind, Professor Andy Clark there, who describes our mind as a leaky organ. It leaks out beyond our skull and beyond what he describes as our ancient skin bag. Gotta love it. And this is an All in the Mind retrospective of sorts. It's the show's 10th birthday season, and we're digging into our archives for ABC Radio National Summer. Back in 2007, we considered progress with a more sophisticated prosthesis, that of the bionic eye, and UK biomed engineer Patrick Degener and Australia's Disability Discrimination Commissioner, Graeme Innes, join me as part of a two-part series on the blind brain.
We do have a long way to go. You know, the eye is a stunning piece of engineering. The more you delve into it in terms of the biochemistry and the biophysics and how the molecules interact with each other, it's beautiful all the way down. For us to replace that with a relatively simplistic silicon chip is quite difficult, actually. Ultimately, my personal feeling is, look, we live in a most amazingly beautiful world, and we want to sense it in as many ways as possible, with our touch, with our hearing, with our taste, with our vision. My personal feeling is that you want to maximize that experience as much as possible. And if we can do this with the implants, you know, then so be it.
For a while, when I was very young, I used to think that because the objects that I'd been able to feel were in other sort of life forms, animals were cats and dogs and things like that, I used to just imagine birds as four-legged animals with wings, until I felt a model of a bird or someone talked to me about a bird, and I remember making that mistake and being quite surprised. And that's happened throughout my life. There are times when I just have to think, oh, that image is wrong.
There isn't a world populated with flying dogs.
That's right, yes. Or, and it happens more often with large objects, such as the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Graeme Innes is Federal Human Rights and Disability Discrimination Commissioner in Australia. He was born blind. I gather you've always seen things in colour too.
Yes.
Where do you think that colour's come from? What's been the reference point for it?
Yeah, for me, because I was born blind, it's object related. So it's from what I've read or what I've heard or what I've talked about. And again, sometimes I get caught out with the colours of things, and I mightn't get that quite right. And I have a 9-year-old who's very keen to correct me when I get those sorts of things wrong.
I can imagine. Fire engines aren't pink.
That's right, yeah.
But what is the sense of red for you? If you've never seen red, what is that conscious sensation?
Well, red relates to sort of fire and sun and brightness, and red's actually my favourite colour, because you know when you've got little kids how you have to have a favourite colour and a favourite animal and all those sorts of things. And I think it's that sense of energy, brightness, whereas, you know, the blue of water is more tranquil, peaceful.
Graeme Innes. Biomedical engineer Patrick Degener is part of the Prosthetic Retina Project at Imperial College in London, where he's lecturer in neurobionics. Neurobionics, you say?
Well, basically what we're trying to do is we're trying to interface electronics with the human nervous system. The human nervous system is very much of an electronic system in of itself. You know, we've gone through millions of years of evolution to create a stunningly beautiful system, which basically far surpasses anything we've got at, you know, present silicon technology. But on occasion, our systems do break down. And where they do break down, we in the neurobionics community are trying to develop things to replace or enhance those broken systems.
Last week we heard about people born blind later recovering their sight and our brain's remarkable capacity to learn how to see from scratch. Even for adults, our brain is more plastic than originally thought. It gives hope to the global effort to engineer a bionic eye or visual prosthesis, because if we were able to plant an electronic chip in the eye to do the work of the damaged retina, our plastic brain could very well learn how to make sense of the new electronic input. A number of diseases target the retina, or the light-sensitive cells at the back of the eye. In age-related macular degeneration and the hereditary retinitis pigmentosa, the deterioration of sight is horrific. One approach Patrick Degenaar's team is taking is to develop technology to enhance a person's vision as it degrades. But if sight goes, a bionic eye could play a role.
The first thing that has to be said is that the eye is not a camera. And in fact, the purpose of our eye is not to take pretty pictures. The purpose of our eye is really to understand the world around us.
And certainly the eye is only one part of the equation. I mean, it's really our brain that does the seeing for us. The eye is really just a vehicle to get the light signals somehow into our heads, isn't it?
You've got the eye at the front. What it does is it senses light, separates the image into textures and colours and motion. It then sends that information back. You've got a way station at the thalamus, basically like a postal office, and it sorts the information. And then if you touch the very back of your head, the very back of your head is where the visual cortex is.
Which is a massive proportion of our brains.
Because we're very visual creatures. Coming back to the retinal implant, if you want to replicate the function of the eye, you can't just replicate the sensing of light. You have to replicate the processing that goes on. It'd be like trying to speak English to a fish. The fish is just not going to understand. So you have to process that information and then connect that information with those communication neurons which go to the back of the brain. So what you need effectively is some form of chip which senses the light. You need some form of chip which does all the processing. You need some form of chip which converts that processed information into a set of stimulation pulses. And then you need some form of system which actually communicates with those communication neurons, communication cells, which communicate
with your brain.
Yeah.
Patrick Degenaar contemplating the bionic eye. And since that show aired, the Australian Federal Government in 2009 allocated $42 million to the consortium Bionic Vision Australia. Over the years, we've looked at various neural prostheses, brains that are part flesh, part machine. But in 2006, we took on the chimeric brain, part human, part non-human. Harvard researchers had transplanted neural stem cells from a human into the brain of a developing monkey to see how the potentially therapeutic cells might function in a living being. But this sort of research raises all sorts of ethical questions. This was at the time also when the cloning and stem cell debates were front and centre in Australia.
Already there are moral issues associated with using non-human primates in laboratory research, but if it's the case that over the course of the experiment, the animal does take on, however faintly, certain characteristics that are not typically associated with that species, but are rather typically associated with our species, then that certainly will raise concerns that this is a kind of very elaborate abuse of the experimental relationship between humans and non-human animals.
I think we all felt very keenly that if you put enough human cells into specific areas of the brain, that there could be a change in the cognitive behavior or function of that animal. But how it would be manifested, we could not reach a conclusion because there's no data on that.
There's a huge interest in this. People do want to know, and people want to have scientists out there engaged in a broader discussion. They want things explained. One of the difficulties in these emotive areas is that most of us have an initial first stab at it based more on a gut feel.
Professor Peter Schofield there, a member of the Lockhart Committee, charged with reviewing Australia's legislation on research involving human embryos and cloning. The big scientific challenge, though, is to study how embryonic and adult human stem cells behave, evolve, and differentiate into other cell types. And scientists need biological bodies other than humans to do the testing and thinking on. This is when non-human animals, like mice and monkeys, are used as living test tubes. With human cells engrafted into them, they become a chimera, a word with its origins in ancient Greece, to others a boogie monster of modern science. Jason Scott Robert is an assistant professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University and their Center for Biology and Society. Jason, let's start with a lesson in mythological history. Remind us where the word chimera originally comes from.
Well, chimera is a very popular creature in ancient Greek mythology. There are a variety of different chimera creatures, including Medusa, the Minotaur, and others, that involve various combinations of different kinds of animal parts in the same body.
So something really, with a lion's head, the middle of a goat, and the tail of a snake, perhaps.
Exactly. That kind of chimera, that's really the most ancient and horrifying kind of chimera. Now you've got various other kinds of things, including any individual who's had a kidney transplant, for instance, would count as a chimera, according to a biological definition.
Indeed. Let's clarify then, in scientific parlance today, what defines a creature as a chimera?
Well, basically, any chimera is an organism comprising a mixture of cells from two or more genetically distinct organisms of either the same or of different species. What really distinguishes a chimera from another kind of interspecies or interindividual combination is that they are mosaics at the cellular level, which means that each individual cell isn't a mixture or a hybrid itself. For instance, if I receive a kidney transplant, the transplanted kidney cells will have a different genetic constitution, but there won't be cells that are part Jason and part kidney donor.
Right, so it's not genetic manipulation as such. It's just swapping some cells for other cells from another species.
Exactly, and if you do it very late in development, for instance, if you do it a kidney transplant into me, there really is very little likelihood that the cells upon transplant will really diffuse throughout my body. But if you do it very, very early in development,
so say at the embryo stage, you take cells, say, from a human and place it in, well, for example, a monkey embryo.
Exactly, or into a fetus. And what you've got there is a very receptive environment for those cells, and they may, in fact, move throughout the body. And
integrate.
Exactly, possibly take on roles that are exactly what we were hoping they'd do, or sometimes maybe not so much. And this is where the element possibly of monstrosity starts to come back in. And this is one of the reasons why the topic has been of such interest in the public eye for the last couple of years.
And certainly this transferring of cells and crossing the boundaries between species, even though it sounds like science fiction, it's been part of science and biology for many, many decades.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that was very interesting to me when we first started talking with stem cell biologists about the work they wanted to do, we were surprised to see how many people actually believe this was a new technique in biology. But in fact, some of the earliest cell transplantation experiments go back to the very early part of the 20th century in the U.S. The creation of neural chimeras, where what you do is you transplant cells from the brain of one animal into the developing brain of another, those have been a staple in developmental biology since the 1960s at least.
For example? With
the quail and chicken chimera system that was developed in the 1960s, basically there were some very interesting biological reasons for wanting to take the cells from the quail and place them into the body, or in some cases the brain, of the chicken embryo. Namely that upon staining, you could tell just really by inspection which cells came from which creature. So it was really a beautiful ability to be able to see what happens to cells upon transplantation, and it gave us a lot of insight into neural development.
Bioethicist Jason Scott Robert. And so to the 21st century, where stem cell science has come of age.
We are growing all kinds of human cells in the laboratory dish here from embryonic stem cells. And we are faced with how do we show that these cells actually will function in an infarcted heart in a rat or a mouse or a pig? How do we look at our neural stem cells, human cells, with respect to a degenerative disorder? Should we be looking at these in rodents? Should we be looking at them in non-human primates?
In 1998, Professor John Gerhardt's team at Johns Hopkins University was one of the first two to isolate and cultivate human embryonic stem cells, a landmark in stem cell research. He argues there's a strong scientific rationale for creating chimeras by transplanting human cells into other living animals, and that is to understand and test the therapeutic potential of human stem cells.
We need good animal models that we can be assured that the cells we have are going to work and that they're going to be safe. And so I see from that standpoint validity to making these animal chimeras for those kinds of studies.
With the complicating factor that how stem cells behave depends on what sort of stem cells they are, what animal they've come from, what animal they're going to,
what microenvironment
they find themselves in. It's a very complex picture that you can make no predictions about.
It is, but the issue is we need some starting information as to will these cells actually function in a heart, whether it's a mouse heart, a rat heart, you know, a non-human primate heart. We need to determine how you introduce these cells, how many cells do you put in, where do you put them in, how do you monitor them, what untoward side effects could come out of this. The only way we can get that kind of information on both effectiveness and on safety is by using some type of an animal model. I think where we're having a problem here is, do we have to go to the brains of non-human primates if we're looking at neural stem cells for function? Higher concerns are raised under those conditions than to say if we're going to put human heart cells into a pig heart or a monkey heart. People, I think, view this very differently.
Well, from a world leader in stem cell science to another, this time in neuroscience, Professor Peter Schofield is Executive Director of the Prince of Wales Medical Research Institute in Sydney. He was on the Lockhart Committee, which reviewed Australia's legislation on human cloning and research involving human embryos. They concluded that human stem cells should not be implanted into embryonic animals to make chimeras. Adult animals, though, are considered okay. So does he think monkeys could be cognitively enhanced by implanting human neural stem cells into their brains?
Well, I think it's still a thought experiment, but I'll have the experiment, or we'll do the experiment together. The difficulty of doing this in an adult animal is that there is, in a sense, only so many human cells that you could potentially put into the animal, and therefore how much would you actually alter it? So this becomes one of those horrible discussions, is 1% enough, or does it have to be 51%?
And is it about more than cells?
And is it more than cells? And I don't even know that you'd be able to get that many cells into an already grown and developed brain. So then the first question is, would putting some cells in alter the species or alter the sort of cognitive status of that animal? When do you actually get enough of the cells in there that they actually start having ability, intelligence, capacity above what's normally seen in that species?
Isn't that work being done all the time by scientists, though? Animals are used as living test tubes for all sorts of cells and living matter, human or otherwise?
Very much so. And if you do an experiment around bone marrow transplantation in an animal model, it doesn't come back and raise the same level of issues. So I guess this... As the brain. So I guess this really does come back to reflect what is it that makes us innately human and what are those factors. One of the great difficulties is they're very hard to put your finger on.
The ethics of the chimera, very interesting stuff. Neuroscientist Professor Peter Schofield there. And that's where we'll leave the brave new brain, another dance through the All in the Mind archives over the past 10 years. Transcripts of the full shows you've heard little bits of today on our website, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. Natasha Mitchell, and a very happy New Year celebrations to you. May 2012 be everything you need it to be.